Amazon Web Services. I'll inject right up front all the caveats I can think about. I'm not Amazon certified. Most of what I'm going to talk about, I've never done. No, that's only half true. When the idea of talking about Amazon Web Services came up in the brainstorming list of things to put on the program, I was sort of intrigued by it because I instantly looked at it and went, "Does AA need this?" And I think the question is always yes, in a certain sense. But I really wanted to make sure that I could talk to the kind of three audiences which we have here, which are kind of people that know very little about technology, people that know a lot of, or whose specific area of expertise might be the software and the typing part, and then the systems people, maybe three general ways, and you know, we all know different things. And Amazon's a little bit like, you know, it's the entire cloud, so how do you reduce that to 45 minutes, right? So what I wanted to make sure was to layer in at the beginning some stuff about really what the cloud is, and it's going to be at a fabric level. I'm going to talk about it like I'd talk to maybe a business person in a light way rather than how I'd talk to a particularly technical person, which I think will land well for everybody. And for those of you that already know a lot about virtual servers and containers and things that the cloud's fabric is made up of, you might enjoy some of the academic, businessy, Gartner quadrant stuff that we don't usually spend a lot of time doing when we're busy implementing it. So maybe that'll help everyone out. But I'll try to fly through this. I want to leave a good maybe 10 or 15 minutes if I'm lucky, but I tend to get analytical, so we'll see, at the end to talk about things, and you can tell me, go back to this slide and talk more about that subject, because I'm just going to kind of extemporaneously talk about each slide, and I've not ever done this talk or rehearsed it, so it'll be what it'll be. First segment, I want to talk a little bit about the shift that we've had in moving from what I'll call the mainframe, a very old term, to the cloud, right? It's been a maybe 20, 30-year journey in a certain type of reality. Gartner is a big analyst company that I like to say that Gartner's really good at putting into words what I just did in the last 6 years. Gartner would tell you that they're very predictive and they're talking about the future. Sort of depends on where you lie in the spectrum of things. This particular chart talks about something that we call pace layering, which is a concept that Gartner introduced back in like 2012. And really, I think IT managers had been doing this in business for a while already, and really all it was technology's changing, and I have a big team, and they can't all do the same thing at once. They need to do more innovative things, and they need to do things that keep the lights on. We've even seen this in AA, right? We need websites, but the email still has to go out, and there's new stuff, and there's stuff that really just has to happen without a lot of effort, or people get bothered. And how do you handle multiple work streams like that? You can put it in multiple committees. It's one of those methodologies. That's what they use in the business world. They can spawn off different departments that do different things. They can create little tiger teams, they call them. They can bring in consultants to do it over here and do things. You know, these strategies are just kind of the strategies that anybody would use. Gartner put it in perspective of systems of record all the way up to systems of innovation, and you'll notice that there's kind of a fast, medium, slow in terms of how these teams would go. There's a modern team type that's called a DevOps team. You see this big stripe up here, and you can kind of see how different teams use these different layers. They probably cut across all teams, but different people will focus more in one area or the other, and they affect management styles. But it's sort of relevant to know the dynamics that went into coping with the cloud or the movement towards what we now understand as the cloud in a certain way. Just 2 years later, they introduced a term called bimodal IT. It's almost like they took something that they tried to express in three layers and said, no, there's really just two things. It's lights on, innovation. And it's much more simple than we used to think. It is mode one and mode two. And in management teams, most technical people never discussed this, but their bosses and the executives behind closed doors were steering to these sort of weird concepts that weren't very technical. Mode one was much like a marathon runner. I thought this was a good analogy. And you can see the sprinter in mode two. The way that you sprint is a little different. You train for sprinting differently. The things you're executing are a little differently. And what you do during what you do is a little differently. And you can see bunch of information here. Almost all the images I'm going to use, I've done a very bad job of being copyright friendly. Haven't checked much of this for attribution. I did this very quick, and almost all of it's very easily available on the internet. So I don't know how valuable the deck will be, because I'm going to talk through most of what's here anyway. But I'll kind of, hopefully the visuals will make more impact than some of the things that I can fill in and kind of time that we have. And then they evolved to start to reconcile. I think it looked to some people like they went, well, we were wrong, and then we corrected it with the bimodal thing. But they started combining these concepts. You can see how the mode 1 and mode 2 is overlaid here. This is what happened right in that 2014 time frame. Change sort of goes one way towards those systems innovation. Governance goes the other way. And the mode 1 and mode 2 people focus are, you know, in different ways. And you can see the little anecdotes there on the right that sort of, that's kind of how you might ask yourself in a business sense what those layers mean. What we were dealing with in 2012, 2014, in terms of Amazon specifically, right, so the evolution of this new thing called the cloud I think of it as like in beta. Big company systems that were on the cloud, there were outages a lot, different regions and zones. It was in the news all the time. The cloud wasn't ready. There was all, you know, it really just looked really, really, really new. I'll tell you today, in almost 2018, is the first time as a technical person who would sell solutions to customers, I'm finally going, oh, it's here. The thing we've been talking about for 10 years is actually today pretty functional, and the downtime is no longer so spotty as it is, at least in the Amazon case, and I'll talk about a little bit about different vendors in a little bit. I want to get some terminology in place so that when I refer to it later, it'll make sense. Scale up and scale out are terms that in terms of what I'll be talking about, I'm going to assume for the audience sake that we're talking about websites mostly. A lot of these terms really were sort of coined and talked about in terms of storage. Amazon, in its entirety, really, if you look at it, is what used to be hardware. Its infrastructure is what we call it. It's going to be your networking and your servers and your, you know, all the stuff that you put your stuff on top of. Except that now Amazon's mostly software. So we have this idea that infrastructure has become code in a lot of ways, and the real infrastructure is abstracted from us. We don't want to know what's down there anymore. We're going to have these virtual software layers that seem like our servers and our you know, boxes and containers, and I'm going to talk more about that. Scale up and scale out was, there was the old mainframe concept that we're coming from, and even the client-server concept. When more people were hitting my application, more people were hitting my website, or my website was more complicated, needed to do more with the database, required more memory, I can scale up. I can make that box larger. I can add memory to it, add more hard disk space to it, multiplex the networking, do all kinds of things to get speed and access into this box, or just get a bigger box, basically. Scale out is the secondary way to do this, which is, think of it more horizontal. Well, instead of making it bigger, I'm going to take my workload into little chunks, and I'm going to spread that across many little instances. And the nice thing here is I gain a lot of resiliency, because some of these can go away and I can still operate. A lot less focus on disaster recovery and keeping my server up forever, because now I've got lots of servers and some of them go down. And that's kind of the new, all the way now, the people that operate strictly in the cloud have this concept of designing for failure. Really everything that we set up now is, failure is what will occur at some points. And in fact, we take things out of rotation enough and put in enough redundancy if we have the budget and the insight to do it, that we just honestly just don't care. If there's servers down, what that really looks like is just something on a report somewhere that somebody's just grooming through things that we used to think of as failure, because our workload is now spread across many devices. So that's the scale out concept. Originally, scale out was talked about in terms of Microsoft SQL Server databases. Came out of a talk that a Microsoft engineer was just kind of spreading around the circuit, and somebody over on the cloud side heard this concept and it kind of fit what they were talking about, but it wasn't really coined to talk about cloud or even specific to storage other than database at the time. So the evolution to this concept of pets versus cattle, right? PETs are unique systems, usually manually built, that are meant to stay up. Right? We have one cat, and we really like our cat, and we're attached to it, and it's a part of the family, and there's a way that we look at our cat. We look at cattle a very different way. Right? Many cattle, they're built in a cloud situation. We even write code to spin up cattle to make it appear rather than sending an engineer to put things together and manually do it. And when a cattle, you can see the little ending comment over there, right? When the cattle gets ill, we know what happens to cattle, right? Different way of thinking about our infrastructure. IDC is another big industry firm that we get good information from. They built this sort of three platform concept of what the old mainframe used to be, what I'll call kind of the scale up world, the big server world, and then the new cloud world used to be. So for our focus, I think what's at least relevant to what we understand about servers today, or where the focus is, most people are usually in platform 2 or 3. And there's a big difference in these a little bit we've already talked about. You can see the number of nines of uptime. Applications become really important over here. That's what we care about. We care that our websites and our software is up. We have less nines down in the infrastructure because there's more smaller infrastructure, and it's not our focus, right? Our focus is keeping those applications up, keeping the business happy. In the old model, we spent a lot of effort making sure that monolith beast was there, and applications took a slightly less focus. I mean, we're talking about a lot of nines right here, so this is sort of a nitpicky subject, but that is where the responsibility shift is mostly occurring. These are the platforms that they talked about. We've gone from millions of users, hundreds of millions of users, billions of users. We're really talking about moving from kind of a corporate, private situation to what we call public cloud. Cloud that everybody really touches in terms of their services, everything from your, the environments that your Google Docs sit on and your devices sit on. We're interacting now with this cloud directly. We used to interact with it much more strongly through a vendor. We'd sign up an account, and there was a whole thing involved. We had very, sort of procedural ways that we would do things with a vendor. And now it's really a commodity. It's a very, very public interface, but totally different dynamics when you have way more users. And the smart people in the industry came up with some of the things that we're talking about to cope with that and to shift over to be able to operate that way. And then in the business world, there's also been a notion that people are, I think business people were really tired of the overhead that was constantly in your way of delivering anything, which was spent talking about setup and hardware. And is it up or down? It's the operational stuff. We really want to get into, can we just talk about the damn website? That's where we should be spending 95% of our time there. And the hardware was so ominous in our lives before that we really couldn't do that. There was a lot of time spent in the setup. Here's another interesting slide that I'll kind of leave for later that kind of gets into specific areas and patterns across those three tiers. You can kind of see where the dynamic levers press a little bit. The chart on the right shows a little build-in area, this modern DevOps role that's become, we had testers and developers and various departments really, and there's kind of a new department that sits in a lot of different places called DevOps. Here's a couple different ways that DevOps fits into companies today. It would be interesting to think about how this applies to an intergroup web committee. People that used to be those technical volunteers over in the orange, and people that were the this is what we know we need in our fellowship or in our local area would be what I'd call the ops people in this vernacular a little bit. A couple different ways to skin that cat. If you want to start talking about a website, you can think about it in terms of what a committee would do. We can totally overlap these people and put them in a committee and just kind of hammer it out. You can do two different sets of the requirements committee can get together and then throw a piece of paper over to the technical people and then they can take over, or you can create a third team. And businesses kind of went through the same evolution. Anyway, they call that DevOps, the new way of doing things. So now we sort of understand where the cloud is in perspective a little bit. I'm going to talk a little bit about the physical features of the cloud. Bare metal is kind of a turn of phrase that we use nowadays to talk about what it sounds like, the old server stuff. And I'll kind of go through a couple different things here that are relevant to cloud. I don't think I have a slide for the very last one, so I'll just make a comment about it. If you do any Googling or looking into things that are called cloud, or even honestly, you see a lot of these terms now in the news, anywhere where they talk about this, you're going to see these little letter XX, you know, AA letter things. What they're saying is software as a service, platform as a service. These are different types of cloud products now, and they indicate which type of service in the cloud it is. And I'll kind of get into what some of that means, but I figured I'd stick the acronyms in the deck. See the mainframes in the upper left. We got something that looks like a server that you would have seen in the 90s, early 2000s, as it transitioned into what the upper right kind of looked like. We went into more bladey type things, and this is a look at one of Amazon's data centers down here in the lower right. I think a lot of people whose focus has just been websites over the last 15 years, I would guess that the concept of a server or a hosting provider or really any kind of internet provider or a cloud provider hasn't meant anything to you. It was still a website just sitting on a different thing back there, and that's sort of true. So a lot of what I'm talking about is definitely, like I said, it's on the infrastructure, it's on the back end. You're getting a little bit of a talk of what that is. At the end result here, what I'm really going to talk about is Amazon, which is that new hosting provider and how it provides its services and maybe some of the opportunities that are relevant. There is a concept of a virtual private server that really since maybe the mid-2000s, I think, has become mainstream. These two terms, VPS, VM, which is virtual machine, are I'm using them in a specific way to convey something to you that if I got just the real technical people together, we'd argue about whether these were used right. And it's not all I really mean to convey is that there is a virtual server concept that if we took one of those larger servers and we installed Windows in a little bubble, if you will, several times on that server, or a Linux operating system several times on that server, and one server now became a host to what we'd think of as multiple different machines. And that was done with software for the most part, so that one set of hardware, CPU and hard drives and whatnot, could now be host to what are multiple servers with their own discrete logins and their own availability. The concept of a VPS is not particularly new to the cloud, but you were still on that single server model for the most part. And the concept of what I'll call a virtual machine for the most part here is we're talking about how you now apply that into the cattle world. And we start to abstract that hardware. I don't even know if it's on a single server or 50. I start to become less aware of it, of what's down there. And that's the distinction I'm trying to make. You'll notice that what I'll call the big three here, Amazon, Google, and Microsoft, all sort of sit in this space. This is maybe the meat of where the processors are in the cloud. They all have offerings there. Containers are kind of a utility zone that holds different types of software that used to sit on servers. In order to make things more like cattle, we need to be able to take operating systems and pieces of code that I've written and other pieces of utility scripts that I've needed and kind of put them like little boxes into places that they can be gotten to in these virtual machines. And the thing that holds those discreetly in software is what we're talking about is called containers. And we could get real technical about this, but you can see that the big difference here in terms of what we're trying to show is that a VM, you'll notice where it says guest OS three times, so it'd be like Windows, 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 and you've got this single set of things that's hosting those three. That would be like a single server. That's more like a pet. The containers over here are showing a much more complex scenario and a little more modern situation. I don't know if I just reverse those. I can barely see my own slide. Anyway, when you get into the cloud and you get into this type of software, it really affects the developer more than I think that the VPSs did. When we were in virtual server world, my job as a developer, I'm still logging into a server in a certain way. I'm putting code in one particular place. I was thinking single server, and anything that was redundant was something that the guy in the back end did, the operations guy who at one point wore a pager and then later on was just on call, and I didn't want his job because I wanted to work remotely and never be called in the middle of the night, right? So I didn't want to know what was back there. But the reality is today when I'm in the cloud, I have to know that my code has to work on this ephemeral landscape, and no matter where it's put, it needs to have been self-supporting, put in our terms. My code needs to be able to be moved in a container and dropped somewhere, and it shouldn't want anything from the environment. It shouldn't be attached to a physical place or some type of addressing or a specific type of syntax. I want to be as devoid of that as possible, and it should just go in and ask questions that are always available, kind of how my code should work. And I think this has evolved into something that's called microservices. You can kind of see the evolution of this as it goes by. Some interesting pictures. I'm not going to go into the details of most of this because it won't be relevant to Amazon, but there's definitely complexity in how we write code to address cloud situations. Some tips for dealing with the cloud, what I'm calling ephemeral architecture. This is when the hardware layer can just go away at any time, and I need to plan for that. Some things happen in the larger environment, some things that when people first go into the cloud, and I can tell you, like the current company I'm working with, it's been interesting to watch for several months of professionals that have been doing this for quite a long time who are totally surprised when things go down that they didn't plan for because they've never had to operate this way, because they've been dealing on bare metal. They can go to a cage with a server and they weren't worried about what that is. But when your server now is a concept and no longer a physical thing in a certain way, there's a lot of things that they learned back in their MIS degrees that they've been ignoring for years. They weren't very planned out. They weren't very, disciplined. They weren't logging things, so there was no place to go look to find out what happened. You know, there were all kinds of things that they now have to do that should have always seemed obvious, but we kind of were able to be lazy about the way the environments were. Plan and code for failure, I already talked about that. It's definitely going to happen. Things are definitely going to go away. Your cloud provider, even, when they do maintenance, they can send you a message and say, we're going to take out this whole area. So, you know, be aware, and then you'll either have to be ready to go redeploy it somewhere else manually, or hopefully you've coded so that there's just a failover that happens and all your stuff spins up in a different area. It's redundant. Realize that your infrastructure is now code. It's because I'm not dealing with a physical server, I want to know lots of things about my virtual server stuff now that I didn't used to know, because it's my application depends on it. That's where that question and answer is happening. Log as much as you can. You will log things about these different virtual appliances all over the place, and just keep that data that you may never look at, because in 5 months when something goes wrong and you want to know what happened, if you weren't logging it, you're not going to know. You might not know. Monitor as much as you can. As much of that logging data, it would be great to be able to know when anything that isn't just standard and obvious happens, that we're sort of aware of it. Make alerts that match your real needs. Used to be that we'd kind of, when certain thresholds happen on a server, we might get an email that was fairly generic. Much better in the cloud if you can be specific about what happened, because there's a lot more things that can happen, and it really sort of sucks as an admin to get a generic something happened and then you have to go on this investigation, which is a little different of an investigative activity than it used to be. And in order to make those alerts relevant to you, you have to actually know what relevant to you means, which means you would have had to think through some of those scenarios in advance. Really good to do the nitty-gritty work of it. Backup and restore procedures should be really well known. The days of I have some automated thing that goes to a tape are long, long, long gone. And now, because there's so many pieces between my microservices, my virtual infrastructure, and a lot of my environment, my network is now code, a lot of these things. Well, restore means really restoring that whole physical environment that used to be physical, but now all that software. So I'm restoring multiple things potentially depending on where my disaster was, my outage. So it should be really highly articulated. Same thing with disaster recovery. It's kind of what I was just saying. It's way more than just data now. A lot of things are data that we didn't used to think of as data because they were physical metal sitting there. So I think we know enough to get into the AWS part. That's what AWS sits on. AWS does what we just talked about in many different ways, and they've been producing and making available services for a number of years now. And so Gartner does this magic quadrant thing. This is as of June, I think, of this year. You'll see AWS way up in the upper right. You can see some of these arrows at the bottom. Vision kind of moves from left to right. The actual offering, what's really available, their ability to give you what that vision is kind of goes from top to bottom. Amazon's just great at it, right? They have moved way up there. You'll see Microsoft down. If I didn't grab a Gartner quadrant from a couple years ago, but I should have. But literally in the last 6 years, you would have seen, I mean, Microsoft down where Google is. You would have seen Amazon about halfway up there. They were way ahead of people in terms of actually being able to execute on some of this stuff. Google's really friendly, more for technical people and certain types of scenarios. They're down in this heavy in this innovation area. They're really in the vision area, but some of it's not quite. You got to do a lot of manual things to use some of their products, a little more than Amazon. Amazon also addresses the consumer a lot more of like AA, our smaller needs than some big companies. Amazon will have more offerings for us in certain ways, and we'll need to know less to use some of them. Even really in the last 18 months, I would say that's become reality. But that's why I'd say why Amazon, and probably the best one to talk about right now in terms of us. First thing about Amazon that I like to tell this, especially to technical people, because I've watched plenty of technical people that they think Amazon's hard to figure out. They literally won't read their website. The most amazing documentation of maybe any vendor I've seen in more than half of my career, Amazon has generated on their website, in their documentation. You can spend more hours than you have humanly available reading through white papers that are not boring or stupid. They're amazing. And they tell you very specifically, this is what our service does in this way. We suggest you do it this way. And there's things like, we didn't know we should turn on CloudTrail logging, which is a service that would cost you, you know, fractions of pennies that starts logging all kinds of things in your general Amazon environment. But if you didn't know to turn it on, you wouldn't be logging that stuff. If you went into Amazon's documentation right in the getting started area, like the first couple things it would tell you is do this. And I've watched $350 an hour consultants that never told you to turn that on because it wasn't obvious to them, or it was so obvious they wouldn't think to know it. Read the instructions on Amazon. They got really, really good stuff. And most of it is not at the level that you need to be particularly technical to understand it. They've done a really good job. Here's a look at some of Amazon's products. It's kind of weird to look at, right? Compute as a product, right? As a product category. Really, we're now dealing with when I go set up a server, if you will, in Amazon. When I go set up a website, I'm going to think about how much processing power I want as a discrete part of the thinking that I go through. It's a different way of thinking in the cloud. In your virtual server and kind of that P2 layer, we would have thought a little bit about this, but not quite so obvious. It would have been more about how many instances am I going to put on a single server, and I do some math. Now I'm really going to get down to what is my code for this website need, and for how many hours a day, and for different tasks as it go up and down. And it's very, you know, it's a really, really different kind of intimacy with your planning, I guess, is maybe a way to think about it. A lot of tools in any case, so we'll get into some of them. Another thing to mention, Amazon has a free tier, which the initial free tier, when you sign up an account, you go to aws.amazon.com, you sign up an account, it's free to do so. These are just the highlights of the things that you get for free. It's an awful lot of compute time. An EC2 instance, we'll get into what it is in a minute ago, but that's basically your virtual server, your VM. They give you a whole bunch of time on these things totally for free. You just get in there and play, spin up networks, build several servers that you don't even need, put little teeny amounts of code on them and do things that are way less than those things need just to play with whatever this stuff is. And you can do it totally free. And on that free tier, it's live. It's not fake stuff. It's totally public. You can definitely run a website for an entire year that needs very low traffic. A lot of our little personal vanity sites don't need any traffic. They're perfect things to stick up on Amazon. And you'll pay nothing. And you'll get a very crazy detailed bill that'll talk about all the things that you aren't paying for. It's pretty neat. Amazon RDS down here on the lower left is there. It's a large database. So some of those AAS things that we talked about, the platform as service, this is what Amazon RDS is. So if you took, and I'm failing here to think if it's MySQL or MySQL, Postgres, MariaDB, several different database offerings within the RDS scope. So instead of me installing MySQL in an EC2 in a virtual machine and bringing up my database, I can sign up for an RDS account and deploy a database within the scope of this environment, right? This platform. I no longer have to worry about the infrastructure, even of the software of the database. I can get right into the tables and the addressing, and I can construct an application where I didn't have to go install the stuff. It's pre-installed, and the kicker is that it's pre-managed. That's the big great thing about the cloud. In the cloud talk we had earlier, I think we heard a lot about patching, right? And that's the beauty here is everything that makes that database stable and having that the physical software of that database that your stuff is on and your data be in multiple data centers, at least three at all times, in discrete geographies, so that you can't ever lose any of that. There's no disaster recovery for you to do. It's as durable as you can imagine. Many, many, many nines in these platform as service products. That's where Amazon gets most of their money. They'd really like to stay in that, doing everything for you right up to the point that you're writing code. The EC2 stuff and a lot of their other products are more of you still totally can do it yourself, and in a lot of businessy ways you may want to. And we'll talk a little bit about that. Let me check in with the clock here. All right, I'll try to speed up. Amazon S3, a little more long-term storage. Lambda is a really interesting one over there for you developers. If you're not familiar with Lambda, you can create, I think of them as functions that just sort of live on their own. It's like a function up here in the air, and I can have alerts that kick it off at some point. I never installed a code base. It just knows Python and lots of things, and I can write it and deploy it and schedule it, and there was no environment set up for me. And I just pay for when that function runs. The amount of time it runs is what I end up paying for in, like, you know, cents is the way that this works. So that's the free tier. The basic infrastructure services that Amazon has, the VPC is what we would think of as networks and firewalls, physical cables and hubs, except the VPC is the software version of that. It just looks like a table of rules that says these protocols can get in, these can't, they can go these places. This is sort of all that is. It's just protocol configuration and some firewalling. The EC2 instance is the virtual machine, like we talked about. VPC peering, I think of it as the gateways between these different networks that you might set up. And it's pretty common now if you set up three servers and you want a high degree of security and flexibility, you'll probably put three servers in three separate VPCs. And you set up your internal IP addresses however you want to do them. You're literally setting up a LAN in the abstract, except it's a lot easier. And, of course, you can do that in CLI. You can do that in script, so that, or you can go to Amazon's console and, in fact, just real quick. This is Amazon's console. I should probably log into my office because I didn't do this. This is my free account, and I'm not going to do a whole lot of demo. But you can see these areas up. Oh, excuse me. We're not on, are we? There we go. Amazon's console. If I were to click into instances, I would see all those EC2 things I deployed or the different products. If I click on services here, this is just to give you an idea of scope. This is most of those products that you were looking at earlier. If I went down here to the VPC link and I clicked on it, this is what we call the console. So more of what you think of in terms of like a normal hosting provider. We get into the console and sort of set things up and configure them. The taking advantage of the cloud a little more would be to, instead of me coming in here and say, click the VPC wizard and start deploying this thing, would be to set up a script that did that behind the scenes, and I'd never see this interface. But, you know, it's a, most of us, at least at the beginning, will be using the console quite a bit. Elastic network interfaces, these are network cards, right? I can attach several of them to my server to go different places and route as part of networking. Network interface can include a lot of stuff. It's really a definition now of a network interface rather than a, obviously, a physical card. basic infrastructure, something Amazon provides. You can see where VPC peering is. The little boxes are the networks, if you will. This is what a typical diagram might look like for something. You can see a web server up here. There's an application down here. That's how they talk to each other, the public internet. It's kind of the new way of diagramming these things. Thought I'd throw that in there. Amazon geographically could look like this. And I can deploy servers anywhere in the world. They've got multiple regions that I just go in and I choose a region. I say deploy it there, and it spins up over there. Our company got, when we first were putting up the proof of concept, we got hacked, and somebody went in into like 10 different regions. They were doing some Bitcoin. They were stealing our compute, right? It cost us about $12,000 in about a day. And they spun up 20 instances, which I think was the max in each region, in like 10 different regions in overnight. And we were logging nothing. Now, luckily, none of this was real stuff. It was a playground for us, and Amazon actually washed away most of those funds. But it was interesting to watch, to actually see that occur. Talk a little bit about storage. So the EC2 instances might be that server, if you will, but you need hard disk, right? You need to put your stuff somewhere. A couple different types of storage, and I'm not going to talk through most of these, but I put in some basic pricing. All this is on their website anyway, but this might be a little condensed thing if you just wanted to use it as an overview. EBS is what most people think of as hard disk, and there's a couple different types, and you can see how they're priced, which is kind of interesting to look at. You know, 10 cents per gigabyte per month. It's a different way of thinking about hard drive. You use what you provision, what you make available, or excuse me, your build for what you provision is what I'm trying to say. So the pricing works. S3 is like a big, you have a web interface to another large storage zone is a way to look at it. A lot of nines up there. It's extremely reliable. It's also very slow to copy files in and out. It's a really good place to dump things for longer term. But if you're serving up files that are just, you know, like if you have a website with a lot of static images and basic, you know, web files are puny, you know, a couple K, they're fast enough coming out of S3 because it's already a web interface. So you can serve websites directly out of S3. You can also do it for as a personal storage device. You can use S3 or different types of Amazon storage using what Amazon calls their storage gateway. Think of it like Dropbox, your own personal version. You go into the console, you launch a storage gateway, you tell it which type of storage, how much you want. You can even make it look like a drive letter on your Windows machine using different interfaces, and you can create your own little Dropbox. And not even have a cloud offering outside of just where you dump your stuff, right, or backing up things that you wanted to do. And much like everything else, you would pay per gigabyte being transferred to you out. Different prices for in and out. It's usually really cheap to get it in, more expensive getting it back out. You can host a website directly from S3. I put a couple of links in here that are quick and easy for more technical people to play with if you want to see it. You can do it with or without CloudFront. CloudFront is a content delivery network. This is the ability, I stick my web files up there and you let Amazon syndicate it, is what we call it, all over the world, so that it's, if I'm sitting, you know, somewhere in Australia and I want my website really, really fast because I have AA customers over there, I guess, and they would get it really, really fast because Amazon did the moving around part for you and all the caching and whatnot. HTTPS is, getting those SSL certificates is just usually a checkbox or a drop-down somewhere in their console or an annotation in our configuration. Amazon LightSail this is really a newer offering where Amazon's trying to address people that would be more like a smaller website. They take those things that we've talked about, the EC2 and the storage and certain amounts of data transfer built into the billing, and they've created little packages, and then they called it LightSail, and they say, if you buy this package, we'll pre-configure it for you. You don't have to go in the console and do all that stuff. And the end result is, if you and I would go in there, we would just look at this like more like a regular old web host of the last 10 years, right? LightSail is kind of addressing that deal. That might be a good place. The pricing is a little more like what we're used to. So they're kind of bridging the gap into this new thing. But they sit right along with the others. You can do a LightSail account spin up a LightSail site and also spin up an EC2 instance, and they can talk to each other. This isn't mutually exclusive. It's just an easy way to, you know, there's some flexibility. Fleet management and auto scaling. This is the very end. I'm going to talk almost none of this, but I couldn't really talk about Amazon without mentioning this, at least so that it was in there. We talked about the cattle, these EC2 instances you can see down here in the diagram. Scaling out would sort of be diagrammed that way. Amazon and all the cloud providers have the ability for you to go in and configure and say, based on a certain amount of CPU thresholds or network thresholds or different things, when that happens, I want to add another EC2 instance that looks just like this one from an image. And it will handle that without me having to worry about it. Or if there's an outage and I get a certain amount of alert or my health check fails for so many minutes, spin up another instance. Or you can scale up. You can do the same. I can spin up a larger EC2 instance and then shut down the other one if I want to do that, depending on what types of things that I need. One of the things that we'll do in my office is our customers, within a couple time zones, work mostly just during the daytime, right? Well, we have an instance that right now in our proof of concepts, it's about 7 terabytes of the database. This thing costs several thousand dollars a month just for it to be up. Just the amount of storage you're paying for, it's not even doing a whole heck of a lot in terms of things, but it's just large, and it needs a lot of processor for the people that hit it. So it's expensive. The reality is nobody's using it at night. But we can't shut it off because a couple people are using it at night. What we're going to do is scale down for half of the day. So for 12 hours, we're going to pay a lot less to put exactly the same thing in less compute, less disk, less whatever. And it's a lot of programming hours to take all the stuff that's in that server and have it deploy in this smaller thing automatically. And if something goes wrong, to redeploy itself in the right thing and to look at all the different conditions that I know now to log so that we know that those conditions happen so that our code can react to them. So auto-scaling, fleet management is what they call that. Docker is probably the winner in the container world right now. It's way ahead of everyone. Two of Amazon's services use Docker containers. Docker is just kind of the leading brand container that you can dump things into and have these containers stacked into your cloud configuration. This is a little bit of what Docker looks like. You can see its containers. You can put different images in these containers. And basically, you have a text file that looks like the thing over on the right. That's what coding your infrastructure looks like in a very, very small way. There's long, long, long lines of code that can go into making a more detailed version of this. But here's an example of creating just a web server container. You kind of tell it which things, stick that code up there, and then you let whichever service you're dealing with. Elastic Beanstalk is one of Amazon's services. It handles everything you see in the gray, and your Docker container is that green thing on top. You deploy your Docker container, and you've already told Amazon what you wanted down there to be available, and it has the ability to spawn more of those according to whichever threshold you've given it. And then even larger, which will probably not apply to AA, maybe ever, this is what's below that level. If you want to define your EC2 instances and allow to take your, let's call it a website, and have multiple Docker containers that address different parts of your application. And I think Amazon has a really good video that shows like one of those container ships that come across the ocean with hundreds of big boxes. Well, they handle all the stacking of that totally automatically behind the scenes at a very granular level. It's really at that microservice level that you saw earlier. And it's, you know, so the cloud is way bigger than most of us will ever need, most businesses will need. And at some point, this will all be what's under there, and we won't even know it. Today, we can sort of play around with it. So Ross is telling me I'm right at the end. Am I over, or am I just right at the end? So I'm done talking. I've probably talked too much. I actually made it within 45 minutes. Please ask away. Any questions? I covered it so well, there's no questions. You got one, Wayne?
Is there any kind of Amazon AWS certification for people that work?
There is, and it is the first certification that my ego would recognize in the last 15 years that I thought was very valuable, mainly just because it's so relevant. There's even two tiers of it. There's one that we'll call it easier, that's more kind of a businessy type of certification. I know most of it, and there's a technical one that's a little harder. I think they're great certs right now. Companies care about them. It's going to be a while before we have this stuff figured out in the real workplace. There's a lot of road to go. So those certs are always valuable when that when the proposition is in our favor.
Wayne from Edmonton Intergroup. Wayne, obviously the EC2 is what we'd be looking at to host a website, right? What is the cost things for us to host a website on Amazon?
I would think of it in terms of the light sale pricing. That's a good way to think about it in terms of these storage and processor lines. This takes Amazon's multiple services, breaks them into a product that looks like what we're used to think of in terms of web hosts, and you can configure pretty accurately to do at or better than that manually. But that's what LightSail really is just doing behind the scenes. You'd go back and see those components that we talked about, or you could spin them up yourself and get that same thing.
So it's awfully cheap. It's just the cost of doing a transfer.
It depends on how much transfer, how much processor, how many people, right? It can get expensive real quick if you're, but that will be a good problem to have if you get people coming to your website. So, yeah.
Thank you.